In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We take another look into the realm of subtle energies of this planet. We've had on several guests describing the range of zero-point energy options available to society, yet continue to be vanquished and concealed by government and corporate entities, despite that energy surrounding us all the time. Our guest, Dr. Serge Kahili King, has termed the ubiquitous energy Vril, to give it a name because Western scientists tend to rename it each time it's rediscovered. In his book titled Earth Energies, A Quest for Hidden Power of the Planet, Dr. King has researched many facets of Vril, such as non-physical healing, vitalizing energy, atmospheric energy, and levitation. Cultures worldwide reference this phenomena, and so do our ancestors. In this book, it reads, quote, "We are likely to find that there is only one energy which has manifold expressions depending on the state of consciousness." This is referencing, for example, magnetism, electricity, crystals, sunlight, geometric forms, human hands, and human thought forms, and more. Dr. King says they all have identical energetic effects. Dr. Serge Kahili King studied with master shamans from Africa to Hawaii and trained thousands in his seminars. He has a doctorate in psychology from California Western University. King is the author of Mastering Your Hidden Self, Imagineering for Health, Kahuna Healing, and Urban Shaman. Dr. King is the executive director of Aloha International, a nonprofit worldwide network of individuals who have dedicated themselves to making the world a better place. We talk with Dr. King about his book, published in 1992. It's titled Earth Energies, A Quest for Hidden Power of the Planet. Aloha, Dr. King, and welcome to Another News.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, this certainly could be a good time for listeners to consider implementing some of the ideas of the researchers you present in your book. For the last century, Western society has lived in an environment that some would argue criminally misdirects people away from learning about how to use the natural energies of this planet. You begin with looking at ancient cultures and their use of natural energy to heal, build structures, and even fly in the air. An important piece of information often left unscrutinized is how ancient civilizations moved giant stones, such as in ancient Heliopolis, now Baalbek, Lebanon, or in ancient Egypt. Would you please talk about what your work and research has revealed in terms of how you suspect monoliths weighing 1,600 tons were moved into place by an ancient culture?
So let's go back to this. All we have today really are guesses. And an awful lot of them are silly. Many are absurd. Very few are feasible as to how they did these things. I'd like to give an example, for instance. On Easter Island, there are these very large basalt statues. They were originally carved on the slopes of a volcano, which was far away from where they were eventually erected. And so the question comes up, how were they brought over there? Well, probably they were carved in place, that we know. But probably they were put on a sledge and slid down to the ocean. There is a path on the volcano that shows that is feasible. So there they were probably put aboard rafts and brought in the ocean around to the places on the coast. These platforms that where we see a bunch of these big statues standing in a row. On each of these platforms, next to it, there is a ramp from the ocean, which lends a lot of credence to that possibility then. So brought up on the ramp, probably, used manual labor and ropes and and sliding things, whatever, mounted on the stones, but then we have a real problem. On top of each of the statues is another type of lava, red, both a lighter color and a somewhat lighter kind of lava, and it had to be set up on top after the statue was erected. And these are big, and they're heavy. And there is no understanding of how that could have happened, except there are legends from Easter Island. In fact, there are legends from a lot of different places that talk. In Easter Island, the legend is that they chanted. The priests chanted, and this raised the stones. But that's not the only place where there are legends and stories that sound of some kind was used as a levitating force. This, we don't know. We can't even say it's probable because we don't really do that today. But it's one of the possibilities, and especially since that's what legends say. But we have to admit, we weren't there. And for all the guesses that might have been made, we really don't know how they moved these things. And I've read some things that really seem silly. Like one of the big things, I saw an article that said, the Egyptologists have finally figured out how the stones were moved. They were pushed along sand by wetting the sand in front so that it would be slippery. Well, that's impossible. I've been to Egypt. The desert is not smooth. It's not flat. These things were away from water, where the stones came from, and there's just no way that that could have been done. So the mystery was not solved. There were things the ancients did that were technologically, in certain ways, well in advance of what we're able to do today.
Do you suspect that some of that might involve a form of levitation?
Well, levitation, of course. But how that levitation was powered is the real question. The legends, a lot of the legends talk about sound as being the thing that powered it. But there has to be a force of some kind that would produce that effect.
Has there been evidence in your particular type of research you've come across, I suppose, that could be used to create a sound or vibration that could move?
Actually, yes. Now, what I'm going to describe is very, very simple, but it does give an indication of the possibility. In some of my classes, I will have, there's different ways that I do this, but in some of my classes, I will have a person sit in a chair. And then I will have four other people stand around to each corner of the chair. And the first thing I will have them do is lift. And of course, they can usually get it maybe a foot or so up, depending on the weight of the person. And then I have them put it down. And then I have all of them remember, including the person in the chair, have all of them remember some exciting event in their life. And to do their best to remember the excitement. And I give them maybe 15, 20 seconds to do that, and then I just tell them to lift. And the lift is way higher. They'll go, you know, sometimes 4 feet. Lifted almost, so the person has to be careful not to fall out of the chair. So what they've been doing, all of them together, have been using the energy of emotional excitement, and then applied that to the lift. Somebody can do it on their own very simply by just standing and trying to, let's say, leap up, jump up to an 8-foot ceiling. And, of course, that's not, unless you're really tall, you can't do that. If they will stand and get excited about something, or happy sometimes, whatever it is, it's a form of excitement, they can jump a lot higher. And I suspect something like this is happening in basketball today, because if you look at the old movies of basketball players, they did well. It was fun and it was nice. But today, some of them seem to be flying through the air in the way they can make those baskets. It's awesome, like it had never been done before. So emotional excitement can produce a levitation effect. some kind of energy vibration must be capable of doing that to it in a bigger way.
That's fascinating. Thanks for going into detail. And I quoted part of your book in the introduction. Quote is, we are likely to find that there is only one energy which has manifold expressions depending on the state of consciousness.
That's what I believe.
There is a lot of interesting research about the fascies and what appears as a bundle of sticks wrapped at each end. Depicted in paintings, frescoes, and sculpture through the ages, it takes on slightly different forms. The fascies often shows up in battle scenes, and some researchers have determined that this may have been actually used as an energy weapon. You refer to ancient weaponry such as the ankh and rods in the first chapter of your book, Earth Energies. Would you talk, please, more about your research into this type of ancient weaponry and including the fascies, if possible?
It's most well known today, most people will know, as a Roman symbol of authority. Apparently, it originated with the Etruscans. But the thing is, the way it's made, there's a central pole. And around this pole, there's a bundle of rods, each of an equal length. And they are tied around this pole in different ways. Now, some of you mentioned that they have different aspects. Sure, sometimes that central pole has a spear point on top. Sometimes the central pole acts as the handle of a pike or has an axe head on top. Sometimes there's an axe with a shorter handle that's wrapped around the bundle. Well, this all seems very strange. What could that possibly be as a weapon? Obviously, it's got weaponry on it or in it. But take this for example, just to give an example. In the book, I also talk about what I call linear energy, which is based on cutting rods or of some kind to a certain length, which attunes them to an energy source that enables that energy to be used for different things. Well, what if these rods were at that kind of measurement? They're all the same length when you look at one of these, and they are bundled together, which would give it an awful lot more energy. Well, suppose its purpose is, in the original form, to empower the weapon. Now, depending on how that weapon were used, if it were a spear, how it were thrown or launched, it would probably increase the distance at which it could be thrown, as well as have a bigger effect on the impact. And as an axe, the same kind of thing. Working as a pike or working as even a smaller axe, it would give tremendous force to any blow that was made with that. And so maybe that's how it was originally used. This is a guess, but it's feasible because we know the effect of these rods of certain lengths and the energy effect that they can have. So I wouldn't say that there's some energy blasting out of the object, but it might possibly, this way of making it, energize the object so it has a greater force.
Getting into the ankh and the rods, if you could explain more about that for listeners, I'm sure they would be interested.
Okay, well, most people are familiar with the at least if they're interested in this field at all, aware of the ankh, which is usually often called the cross of life. It's got a loop on the top, it's got a crossbar, and then a long projection down. In 1980, I was able to be in the Cairo Museum. And at that time, things were so much more accessible, so I was able to spend a good amount of time studying some of the oldest forms of the ankh. And what I found consistently was that the crossbar was originally a knot that bound the loop with the rest of the let's call it the rod below. It clearly indicated that the loop was a, you might call it either feminine or negative in the sense of polarity, not in the sense of bad. And had a, how can I put it, a softening effect. And the rod down below was more male and had a more destructive effect. This comes from looking at different frescoes in the area, where this was actually shown in the frescoes, where a god figure would be shown holding an ankh, pointing the loop in a protective way, and others in which it was reversed, and the god figure was holding the ankh, pointing the rod that cast out a beam like it was attacking something. So there's an indication here of the possibility that this was originally some what form of electricity or electrical kind of thing, like a lightning rod or something like that, that was both a weapon and a defense. That's the way it looks like in the frescoes. So it had to be connected to energy in some very strong, practical way.
We often see that image all around and not being wielded as a weapon very often. It's not shown that way.
That's right.
A past guest who goes by the name of Crow777 suspects that space is likely more a liquid than gas. And Franz Anton Mesmer called it the universal fluid. He continues with this, a fluid universally diffused, so continuous as to admit no vacuum, incomparably subtle and naturally susceptible of receiving, spreading, and communicating all motor disturbance, is the means of its influence. This is in your book, I think it's the third chapter. You go into detail about the life and work of Franz Anton Mesmer. Would you talk, please, about his research and work with Earth energies?
Okay, well, I'll start with his and then have to relate it to some other things. But there was so much about him and so much he did and wrote about. I have to give just a summary. Now, he used that concept of a universal fluid permeating everything, something like the ether that early scientists talk about. But he had a huge difference. The big difference in his concept of this universal fluid, if you like, was that it was psychodynamic. Now, what he meant by that, and this is where it becomes most interesting, what he meant by that was that not just have a physical influence, but be influenced by will and intent. And so he demonstrated this over and over again in the healing work that he did, using magnets as a source or stimulus of this fluid, if you like, and did many, many healings. He also did many other kinds of experiments. He was, of course, completely, you know, put down by his colleagues who didn't like the idea of healing without medicine, which is something that's not gone away yet. But he did use it, and unfortunately, the way he used it was to, with will and intent and environment and suggestion, he would, because he had said that people have the ability to refuse that influence. So he would set up situations in which people would be more likely to be open to it, with the environment, with music, with drama, with all kinds of things, so that he would have a much, much greater effect. Later, people just picked on they didn't like the fluid idea, so they just picked up on the suggestion part and gave that name to hypnosis, which would have really upset Mesmer. So they talked later about mesmerism before the word hypnosis was finally accepted. But that's not what he was doing. He was actually focusing this energy and using it to influence mind and body and environment. Now, the interesting part is that when we talked about some of the later people, like Reichenbach and Reich, they're basically reinventing the same kind of concept, except the distinction with Mesmer was his idea that it could be mentally influenced.
It seems that this energy, whether you would accept it or not, it could be based on your own free will.
Yes. How it's used. In fact, we use the concept in teaching people how to heal themselves and help others.
Dr. King, you were studying and replicating some of Dr. Wilhelm Reich's energy research back in the early 70s. Reich and his research into orgone energy is the subject of one of your chapters in Earth Energies. Please tell listeners about your experience learning about Wilhelm Reich and orgone.
Okay. Now, orgone is a name that he gave to this subtle energy. Let's use that term. In the book, I call it Vril, based on some even earlier work, but it happens so often that the people who begin working with this give it their own name. So the name that Reich gave it was orgone. He discovered that if he would put certain kinds of materials together, most particularly a conducting material and an insulating material, although he didn't think of it that way, why there would be a field, a concentrated field generated. So this universal energy, by means of basically creating a capacitor, would be concentrated and therefore have a stronger effect. So he did all kinds of things with this. He created something called an orgone box, which would be a box almost like a crate, maybe about 6 feet high, and he had certain materials that he would use to combine it, to put together, to create this energy effect inside, very concentrated, and he would have people sit in it. The idea was that this energy would create movement that would release the tensions in people that were suppressing their health, wealth, and happiness. And what got him into trouble was that he was saying, not only was this non-medical, that was one of the problems, but what really got him into trouble was that he was advocating that this be used to generate orgasms, which he said was one of the most healthiest things that people can do, and promoted having children as young as five participate in this. Well, that got him into a great deal of problem. And when they said, what was his downfall? It didn't directly have to do with his orgone work. It had to do with the way he thought it ought to be used.
As listeners may know, there's deadly orgone radiation and positive orgone energy. You explained in your book, Earth Energies, how Wilhelm Reich had built a cloudbuster to dispel the DOR, or deadly orgone radiation, lingering around his lab at Rangeley, Maine. Would you describe, please, to listeners, how the cloudbuster works?
Okay. I have to begin, however, by emphasizing that the deadly orgone energy was Reich's interpretation of what was happening. Okay? There was definitely a very high energy concentration happening in his laboratory area, and it was having some bad effects. But he's the one who decided that it was deadly orgone energy. Okay? I look at it differently, but that's where that came from. At any rate, he had noticed in some of his experiments that when he pointed a tube, let's say like a pipe, at a body of water, it would seem to stimulate the movement of the water. And that's what first gave him the idea. And he found in various experiments with, it's called a cloudbuster because he eventually put a whole group of tubes together that would look like an anti-aircraft gun today. And he would put all these tubes together and bind them together and have them connected to a water source as a kind of insulating thing. And he would point this at the sky, and if he pointed it at clouds, it would dissipate the clouds. And so this was his idea about dealing with the deadly orgone energy. He made the cloud buster and pointed it at the areas in his research place, to dissipate this collection of energy, this concentration of energy. But then he did turn it more to working with clouds, because he also found that if you would point this group of tubes at an open place in the sky, it would attract clouds. And he used this in a number of different experiences to bring rain to different places that were in a situation of drought. And I saw this personally at a Reichian conference in Toronto one year. Somebody had built a cloudbuster, and weather report said that was clear weather, you know, for the whole next week. And so this cloudbuster was pointed toward the horizon in an evening, and overnight the sky filled with clouds, and we had rain the next day. So the thing worked. But that's what the cloudbuster was.
On one end, I think you mentioned, and this is in the model of Reich's cloudbuster, on one end of the tubes there are flexible plastic tubing that flows into the water or a water source. Would you talk about that?
They were flexible metal tubing, not plastic. And they were put into the water to serve as a ground, like we do with electrical systems today.
Were you ever compelled to make one of your own?
I never made a full cloudbuster, but I did a lot of experiments with tubes. And I found that they had a even more powerful effect if I would make the tubes to a certain length, so that you had the tubular effect as well as the length effect. And working with plants and working with people, using those to make a pyramid gave it an even greater effect. So, there's a lot of very useful and exciting things that can be done with that.
You had mentioned in your book, Earth Energies, that a follower of Wilhelm Reich, Jerome Eden, claimed two orgone motors were stolen from Reich and delivered behind the Iron Curtain. In 1956, in a court appeal, Reich himself briefly mentions the 1948 experiment and went on to say that it was the first step in, quote, the technological development toward noiseless, smokeless, smooth-functioning locomotor machines of the future. Would you talk, please, more about the orgone motor in terms of how it functions?
Sure. Well, how exactly it functioned, nobody can really say, because there are no diagrams, and never has been anything on paper that lasted or was published so that somebody could see how such a thing would work. Reich himself did mention an experiment that had five witnesses, and that in the experiment they were able to cause a motor to move. How much and what kind of motor is not explained. Although Jerome Eden did claim that, I find it highly doubtful. And one of the problems with that first experiment was that somehow or other, according to one of the witnesses, a car battery was involved, or some kind of battery anyway, that kind of puts a question on what was actually making the motion. So we really don't know. I did an experiment myself to see whether there would be any kind of an effect. Now, what I found was, through my simple experiment using C batteries, and I had a test of four different ones and placed them in certain... One of them I had a control far away from the others, and the others I placed in different energy devices. And first thing I did was drain them all. They were all 1.55 when I measured them to begin with. And then I drained them all and then put them on these different devices. On what I would call, in the book I call it a monobox, but it was an orgone-type device that was quite strong. I'll just talk about that one simply. You see, if you just leave a battery out, like I drained the C battery, if you just leave it out, it's going to recover some of its charge all by itself. Well, over the course of 22 days, to make it real quick, the C battery by itself, the control C battery, brought itself back to 1.2 volts. The C battery brought it back to 1.1. The battery on the charger Monacharger brought it back to 1.2. Very small, but bigger than what it could do on its own. And it simply indicates a possibility that under the right concentration, this subtle energy could recharge a battery. That's a far, far cry from running a motor. So I would think it would have to be an extremely high concentration to have any motive effect at all.
I saw that experiment in one of your chapters, and it got me thinking, if atmospheric energy such as orgone can charge voltaic batteries, can orgone accumulator devices be created to charge systems such as car batteries, for example?
Sure. That's a good possibility. What I think about all these devices is what they do, like he called it, an orgone accumulator, recognizing that this energy is everywhere. He created devices to concentrate it, and he even recognized, although it's not published, I found this out at his site in Maine, that he also experimented with crystals as what we might call accumulators or concentrators. And so somehow or other, you'd have to have a device that would concentrate it enough to produce a more physical effect. Now, this is what pyramids do. They're all doing the same kind of thing. They're concentrating this subtle energy that exists all around us. What I found was that there were more effects on that were easily noticed on food than on other physical kind of movement.
Dr. Wilhelm Reich made smaller orgone accumulators for food and things like that. At one point, there were a lot of psychologists in New York City, and it was popular to have an orgone accumulator box for your patients in your office.
But after Reich was arrested in the 50s because of his social ideas more than anything else, I mean, they really, really went far. And remember, he was accused of being a communist. This was that period. He was put into jail. He died mysteriously. Nobody knows why, because he was a healthy man. His books were all burned by court order. It was years before they could be published again. And fortunately, that was during the years when I was doing my experimenting. But it was really amazing. And all the orgone boxes that were all at all the doctor's offices were confiscated. Now, just as a side note, I built one of those myself and made it very strong. And I decided to sit in it until something happened. Now, Reich had talked about, you know, bringing on orgasm, but he also talked about difficulty sometimes with getting through the restrictions that have built up in our bodies, mental and emotional resistances. So as I sat in that box and kept sitting in it, what started to happen was a return. When I was in Africa, I was in Africa for 7 years, and I got malaria. So that was still in my bloodstream. And I hadn't had, you know, only under high stress would I ever get any of the symptoms back. Well, boy, it was high stress inside this box. And I decided, I'm just going to let it happen. If I die inside here, I die. I want to find out what happens. And so I just stayed there through all of these terrible symptoms of, you know, basically fever, nausea, pain. And after just before the 4 hours, I felt like there was, the only way I can describe it is a kind of explosion in my body. And all the symptoms were gone and never, ever reappeared, no matter how stressed I got.
Dr. King, you were studying Wilhelm Reich really before many people were doing it. And how did you learn about him way back in the 70s?
Well, I came back from Africa, and I had a lot of interesting experiences there, but I came back from Africa in 1971. And at that time in the United States, there was this full blooming of states of consciousness, of New Age ideas, of different healing systems. I mean, it was hard for anybody to believe today what it was like. But so this was so interesting. It just interested me completely because I had had contact with some of these let's call them psychic or spiritual things while in Africa. So I decided to go into it. And one of the things when I began researching led me to Reich, and Reich first, and then with more research back to Reichenbach and Mesmer and all the people who were involved in that kind of thing. So my first thing was, okay, well, I was very interested in pyramids as well and was doing a lot of experimenting. And I decided, you know, maybe this is the same energy. Now, I knew that you could sharpen a razor blade in a pyramid. And so I wondered if you could sharpen a razor blade in an orgone box. So I made a very small one. Sure enough, actually, I used a plastic soap box lined with aluminum foil, put a razor blade in it, and it sharpened just as well or better than the pyramid did. Eventually, I discovered that what it was doing was dehydrating the water from the edges of the blade, which made it resharpen, really. It did not have a direct physical effect on the metal, but it did have this evaporation effect, and which is also the dehydration effect that it had with food. That's how those things got all connected together.
I was reading about that. You mentioned something about crystals on that edge of the blade as well. What was that about?
Well, when in the way that the blade is made, it becomes a crystalline structure at the sharpness, where the sharpness is created. That crystalline structure has interstices or gaps into which water can collect after a certain amount of shaving and produce the effect of dulling the blade. By using an orgone box to resharpen the blade, I was able, just using a plain blue blade razor, some people today wouldn't even know what that was, I was able to get 700 shaves before it would not cut anymore.
That's very interesting how water dulls the blade, and you extended the life of your razor blade and even a disposable razor blade. I'm sure it would extend the life of that maybe double or something.
It was a disposable.
I got you. Okay, yeah, so I certainly didn't recognize that name.
Right. I'd like to say people today, that was the cheapest blade there was at the time.
I'm sure companies such as Gillette and the others really don't want you to know about this.
That's understandable.
Okay, I was reading the section on the Odic Force and the human body and specters at cemeteries and was reminded of being at an open casket funeral a few years ago in an Orthodox church. And during the ceremony, I watched an iridescent purple light circle the top of the head of the deceased and slowly fade away. And then a pink one showed up and it slowly faded away. It reminded me of a miniature aurora. Would you tell listeners, please, about the work of Baron von Reichenbach and some of the things that he's discovered that are similar?
Okay, well, he was a well-known, well-respected scientist in the late 19th century. And he, discovered or created creosote as one of the things that he was famous for. But then he began, again, getting into this subtle energy area. I don't know how or why, but he began to experimenting. He called the force Ode. And he did thousands of experiments to demonstrate its existence. Now, he, of course, fell into disfavor, and partly because what he was using for his subjects were, at the time, what were called sensitives, which we would say people who were psychically sensitive or clairvoyant. And he conducted a lot of his experiments, especially with crystals, in totally black basements. And he would have the sensitive sit in there and then eventually describe what they perceived with these different devices that he gave them, including crystals. And they began to be able to see light coming off the end of the crystal, Today, people who work with crystals kind of take that for granted, but that was a totally different thing at that time. And so a kind of a bluish light coming out of the pointed end kind of a dull reddish light coming out of the matrix end. And then he discovered with more experiments that each of these had different effects on plants, on animals, and on human bodies. He also did a lot of experiments with magnets and getting the same effects. And I'm just going to throw this in, where industry has used some of this knowledge is that magnets are used in many industries for dehydration effects. And my thinking is that it's because magnets also, in addition to the attraction effect, they also have concentrators of this subtle energy.
He was seeing similar types of aurora colors and images like that. I don't know if that was a result of magnets interacting with subtle energy. I'm really not sure.
Okay, well, no, he began to realize through the help of these sensitives, he never said he saw it himself, but he was able to experiment with the effects of that. And so, no, there were more things. The just like Mesmer, he got the idea that this energy is all around and manifests itself in different forms in different places.
How did you learn about Reichenbach's work?
Now, during the 70s, an awful lot of stuff was available that you never see anymore. But since I was experimenting, going into Reich and looking for anything similar, that's what led me to Mesmer and led me to von Reichenbach. And I still have some of his works in my library.
Dr. King, a friend of mine named Steve White got me into reading about the research on Tartaria buildings, to be specific, that had incorporated some type of etheric energy into it. I suspect these older buildings could have had some type of wireless system in them to distribute atmospheric energy. It's then claimed those properties were often purchased in the early 1900s by certain wealthy entities, then the systems covertly removed, yet the shell of the building is intact. Have you looked at this research, or are there parallel concepts in your research?
I've looked into this, too, and visited a great many places. And I agree that the way that they were constructed did generate a concentration of subtle energy within them. I don't think there was any wire involved, and I don't think there were any devices involved, except for whatever a person might be able to sit on or touch inside the structure. And so, yes, I'm firmly convinced. Two occasions I can think of in particular. One is the cathedral at Freiburg in southern Germany, where there's one spot under the main tower, and this is known, this is shown to tourists, but if you stand under it, you get this incredible energy effect, which is different from stepping a foot around it. These could easily have been used by people who knew how to use it, priests at the time, to encourage or induce certain effects on the congregation. I would assume mostly healing. And another place, I was visiting an old cathedral, actually more like a church, I guess we'd call it, in France. And I remember the oldest part of it was in the back end, and I would sit in there and feel this wonderful, incredible sense of peace. It's really hard to explain. It was just amazing. And this is the church had been extended out toward the front, of course, built in more modern times. And when I walked into that, it was just a building. But the back end still had this powerful, peaceful effect.
Do you think that is a residual or an accumulation of maybe a positive orgone energy, to call it something?
I would say ongoing, because the back end of the church still had the same old structure on top. I wouldn't say residual. I'd say ongoing.
You mentioned there's no device, but I was wondering if, do you think there might have been devices in the more modern maybe the late 1800s or something, where they had chandeliers that were not gas, and they could have a filament in there, but brought to light from maybe atmospheric energy.
Yeah, well, without actually seeing one of those working, I really wouldn't be able to, but let's go back a lot farther. There are frescoes in Egypt that, without any doubt whatsoever, are showing a lamp being fed by electricity, by an electrical cable. I mean, this is real. This is old. This is ancient. And it looks like a modern filament lamp. So they were doing this somehow. Another case, just briefly, of what might be called a device. When I was in the Great Pyramid of Egypt with a friend, they have they call it a sarcophagus, but it was actually a big basalt, okay, box, open box on top. And we decided to do an experiment. And so we went over and we stood by the box and we put our hands in it. And I don't know who started it or why, but we all began to hum. And we hummed a particular note that we had found that room resonated to. And green light formed around our hands, honest to goodness. And we'd take our hands out, it was gone. We put our hands in and hum, and that each one of us had a green aura form around our hands inside that box. And so, well, there's an indication that generating light is most definitely a possibility.
Thousands of years ago, there are images of what appeared to be light bulbs or electricity bringing light. There's another realm in your book, Earth Energies, that you speak about, Dr. King, and that is dowsing. And you mentioned an expert dowser, Vern Cameron. He was so good. He was not allowed to leave the U.S. during World War II because he could locate U.S. submarines with his ability to douse. Would you tell listeners more about dowsing, and is this activity using the same type of universal energy?
Yes, it's working through that, using some kind of device that gives you feedback. And so it can be a stick. Vern Cameron invented a really nice flexible metal thing that he could use for dowsing. But you can use the hand, too. You can learn how to be sensitive with your hand itself. And you can be sensitive enough so that you can feel energy, different levels or intensities or concentrations of energy in different places. And when you put your focus on something, then you can interpret the reactions by creating a mental system, so that you can, let's say, how deep is the water, how fast is it running, what's the direction of it. This is real stuff. There are people still doing this today. And I knew a priest in West Africa, used to be Upper Volta. He used this to locate 5,000 wells for that country.
It's similar for Wilhelm Reich bringing rain into a drought-stricken area. It's still finding water.
Oh, sure. That's right. Water is very sensitive to human will and intent.
I wanted to ask you, have the practical applications of real energy accelerated as expected with the advanced and quicker ways to exchange information worldwide?
What do you think? I have a network of people that we work together on this kind of a thing. But it's like this information goes in waves. It was incredibly high wave of this in the 70s and 80s, and then it faded away so that you hardly hear anything about any of this stuff today. What may happen is another wave that will start and get interest in it and activity in it again. This is a kind of a fundamental thing of human nature. But there are many people, of course, that have never given up on it and are still studying it and practicing and using it. I use it, and I'll just mention briefly that I'm 82, and healthier than most other people I know, much younger.
Yeah, you sound great, Dr. King. What are your thoughts about human environments saturated with microwave and millimeter wave wireless radiation and the related efficacy of our connection with natural earth energies?
Okay, let's do talk about that. It's not just human environments. It's the environment itself that's saturated with radiation of all kinds from all over the universe. Radiation itself is of any frequency is not the problem. It's the concentration of the radiation. And the reaction, mostly the reactions of humans to that radiation. This is very important to understand. I'm trying to get this across. Think about the ultraviolet nature of radiation from the sun. So some people are more sensitive to it because of the nature of their skin, others because of their state of stress. So in general, the more stressed you are, the more sensitive you are to any form of radiation. Because consciously or unconsciously, you're resisting it. The more you can de-stress by any means, the less sensitive you'll be. And in the case of sunlight, for example, and I've taught many people this, the more quickly you can recover from an overdose, no matter what kind of skin you have. So the stress effect is what is the problem in terms of radiation.
That's really helpful to understand. Do you suspect, however, that humanity and nature in itself is in trouble with 5G, for example, millimeter wave wireless radiation in their environments and the cumulative effects?
Okay, personally, I don't. Overall, I would say no, because it's just another range of radiation that already exists. But if it's concentrated enough, there will probably be some people who will have a problem, just like there are some people who cannot endure these overhead electrical wires that provide electricity. They get very sick. They have all kinds of problems. So people who are under stress for whatever reason will probably have some effects from the 5G, and I suspect most people won't.
You write, if the ancients could do such amazing things as moving huge stones, providing cold light, and traveling through the air and possibly space by relatively simple means, there is no reason why we can't do the same today. What are your thoughts about this statement now in a new decade of the 21st century?
The only reason we can't do it is because we don't know how yet. As long as people keep investigating, keep exploring, keep experimenting, there's no limits to what human beings can do with the right focus and the right energy.
Dr. Serge King, I think we just scratched the surface of the material in your book titled Earth Energies, A Quest for the Hidden Power of the Planet. You are the author of many other books and the executive director of Aloha International, a nonprofit worldwide network. Would you tell listeners about Aloha International, and if listeners want to reach out to you, how would they do that?
Okay. The Aloha International is a worldwide organization. It's an arm of HUNA International. It's an educational arm, and we have a website, www.huna.org, which has over 300 articles, free access to different forms of healing and ideas about energy and the things that are possible to do. Anybody can access that. We have probably 75 or more videos of excerpts of different talks that I've given. Those are free access on YouTube, so people can access that way. If they want something more specific, we have some booklets we send out. They can contact huna@huna.org. And we'll send out these booklets free to individuals anywhere in the world.
There's a wealth of information here that the listener can pick up on and really transform their lives, their communities, and learn about the enigmatic nature of the universal energy existing all around us all the time. Dr. King, thank you again for being on In Other News.
Thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. To hear this show again, visit inothernewsradio.com. Thank you.